no cause for alarm.
All right, this is Pure Decking show number 472 for Thursday, March the 24th, 1874. This is the show about stuff that interests me, like information security, rigging the game, and realizing I still have last week's joke on the show notes. Tonight, we have Madman. What's up, Madman?
Hola. I'm working on one of Mark Twain's greatest quotes. Too much bourbon is barely sufficient.
It's a good quote. I like that quote.
I think I may have to grab more bourbon halfway through the show because this has evaporated faster than I assumed it would.
Well, I need to go get some more. I don't have much left in the cabinet. So, and Raven, are you?
Well,
what is up?
I am just applying another layer of duct tape to my headset.
Eventually, you're going to have to give up and just, you know, go get you some clothes hangers and rebuild it.
It's more duct tape than it is headset right now. But I will outlast PSV's headset.
Well, that's where my last one got to before it finally gave up the ghost. And I still have the ear drivers and the microphone element from it because I'm going to rebuild it at some point. But I had
3D print the rest of it just to fill it in.
Well, that's kind of what I did before it finally, you know, the cording on it finally died again. Which was I had 3D printed a bunch of inserts and then ordered some neoprene and had made a sleeve for it and completely reworked the whole band back up from like this two little strips of spring steel that were left in it after the last time it fell apart. And but yeah, I'm going to eventually 3D print the whole thing and get that headset up and running again. The only real problem was that it used a non-standard connector at the base, and so every time the cord would get a short in it, which unfortunately I tend to run over the cord to my headset with my chair, so it happens more often than it should, so I tend to wear the cords out faster than you would think.
But yeah, because I was thinking that doesn't happen very often, the cord shorting out on most of the headsets I've owned.
Well, that's the cool thing about these these Audio-Technica broadcast headsets I like. I mean, they're expensive as hell for a headset, but I mean, they're modular, the cords are replaceable, which is always what seems to die for me on a headset is the cord. So, although, no, I did have that one several years ago that had developed a twist in the microphone and just shorted all the cables out, so it was a feedback nightmare. But after I replaced it, I took it apart to figure out what went wrong with it because it was so strange. And it's like, oh, look at that. It's bridged all the connections at this little circuit board in the headset. So I don't even remember what brand that one was now, but I had it forever. Anyways, though. But yeah, eventually 3D print and get those other pieces up and going again just as an extra headset because why not? They're still good. Just need a bit of soldering to put some proper standard connectors on them and a housing. So that way I can use whatever cord I want with the damn thing. Just make my own. But anyways, I guess we'll start off with the first story here. It's kind of an obvious one, kind of an oh duh. Deplorable scam emails, fake fundraising for Ukraine. Because of course they do. Every time there's some kind of global event, disaster, or something else that people are going to do fundraising for, the scammers come out, set up a PayPal box or a donation box or a fake storefront, say, I'm collecting money for Ukraine. You know, spam the fuck out of people's email boxes, collect a few $100,000 and disappear into the night. Because of course they do. UK's National Fraud Reporting Center is warning about fake emails pretending to raise money for victims of the war in Ukraine. Action Fraud has received 196 reports of bogus requests to fundraise for victims of the crisis. Scammers use a variety of methods to con donors, including selling charity t-shirts, it says. Some are even pretending to be Vladimir Klitschko, whose brother Vitaly is the mayor of Ukraine's capital, Kyiv. Action Fraud has shared advice about how to detect the scams, never click on links or attachments, and suspicious emails or respond to unsolicited messages asking for personal or financial details, even if they are in the name of a charity. To donate online, type the address of the charity website in rather than clicking a link. Be cautious when donating to an online fundraising page. Fake ones are often badly written and contain spelling mistakes, not as often as they used to. Actually, a lot of the email scams do that shit on purpose. You know, put the bad grammar and stuff like that in. It's like, you know, yeah, they could subscribe to Grammarly and get all that fixed if they wanted to, and they know that, but they don't because they want you to think you're smarter than them.
Yeah.
They want you to think, oh, I'm going to pull one over on them. So, you know, it's done on purpose. The representative said...
confidence thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The representative said the links and emails lead to malicious websites that are designed to steal your money and personal information. When donating, check the charity's name and registration number on a government's website. Most charities with an annual income of £5,000 or more must be registered. That's UK-specific advice, but just in general. Yeah, if you see an organization you've never heard of and you feel like donating to them, you know, Google it first, make sure. Or Bing. I guess you can use Bing. Or DuckDuckGo, or pick one. Cirix. According to the Charity Commission, the most efficient, helpful way to support those in need is give money to established, registered charities with experience delivering humanitarian aid. Yep, and then they've got a link to the UK Charity Commission register. So, apparently there's also, you know, the article goes on talking about crypto cons and some other things like that, but I mean, it's the same standard stuff, right? I mean, this is nothing new.
No, it's seen everything, man. But even charities are a fucking scam.
Well, a lot of the established ones actually are. It's like, oh yeah, 75% of our operating cost goes to overhead. Wait, what?
Yeah. Exactly.
If you want a good one that most of your money is going towards the charity, give directly.
Yeah.
I think 98% of their money actually goes to what it says it's going towards. That's the highest of all the charities.
Buy your local homeless some drugs.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm just thinking we all did that Humble Bundle thing because, you know, the 20 bucks off on Back for Blood. I'm wondering how much of Humble Bundle actually makes it now because we all did that one the other day to get the games.
I have no idea how much of it's going to go to Ukraine, but anybody who wants a decent price on some video games, Humble Bundle has a Ukraine donation bundle for $40.
Yeah,
I don't know if any
of
the money will show
up
to
though.
Ukraine, but it's cheap video games.
Yeah, well, there's that. It says 100% donated, so we'll see. But when does this one end? Because I know it was ending soon. And this is a stupid long list. Let's see. Does it not say? I thought it was ending soon, but oh, here it is. Yeah, offered ends in 15 hours, 50 minutes. So if you're hearing about it on this recording of the show and it's been more than 15 hours from, well, now, you missed it. So, but yeah, they claim 100%, so we'll see. I don't know.
Well, I'm not going to see because I'm not following up on this. I don't care enough. I got my cheap video games, and that's the whole reason I bought the bundle.
Yeah, there's that. So, but yeah, I mean, it's the same spam advice that's, I mean, for anything, right?
Yeah, it's going to be good for the next hurricane because this isn't just a Ukraine scam. It's any natural disaster or humanitarian problem scam.
Hell, half the time they'll make up shit if there's not something really going on in the news. So,
that's just lazy. I mean, there's been a war somewhere every year since before I was born.
Yeah.
You can just look them up. Now, granted, they might be in areas of the world no one with money cares about. But There's still wars there.
All right. Oh, we're probably going to blow through these fairly quick tonight. Let's see. This next one is from techradar.com. Microsoft source code breach may be much bigger than thought. 37 gigs of Microsoft's internal source code has been leaked online by the Lapsus group. Saying has an option to listen to the article. I guess I could just play it instead of reading it, but we're not going to do that. After allegedly gaining access to Microsoft's Azure DevOps source code repositories over the weekend, the South American-based data extortion hacking group Lapsus has now made some of the company's internal files available online. In a recent post on Telegram, the group shared a screenshot of Microsoft's Azure DevOps account to show they had hacked one of the company's servers, which contained source code for Bing, Cortana, and a number of other internal projects. Now, though, Lapsus has made source code for over 250 Microsoft projects available online through a 9-gigabyte torrent. According to the group, the torrent itself contains 90% of the source code for Bing and 45% of the source code for both Bing Maps and Cortana. I'm just trying to decide, does anybody care? Like, if it's the source code to DirectX or parts of Windows, yeah, people fucking care. But Bing? I guess Cortana's in Windows, so that one might matter.
Well, I guess if you wanted to try to make a competing search engine to Google and didn't want to do any work.
Yeah, there's that.
With a clone. I mean, it's better than starting from nothing, perhaps, but Bing kind of lost that fight.
Well, with a search engine, it's not the code that's valuable. It's the link database and how you've got it all tagged and you know, what kind of, you know, ranking your search does, you know? That's why Google was so great back in the days. Their algorithm was actually really good. And nowadays, not so much because they've, you know, gotten all editorial on it. But, you know, that was back in the day, it was great. So... But while Lapsus says that they only leaked some of Microsoft's source code, security researchers spoke with Bleeping Computer say that the uncompressed archive contains 37 gigs of projects. After examining the contents of torrents more closely, the security researchers are confident that the leaked files are legitimate internal source code from the company. In addition to internal source code, some of the leaked projects contain emails and other documentation that was used internally by Microsoft engineers working on mobile apps. The projects themselves all appear to be related to web-based infrastructure, websites, or mobile apps. At the time, it seems that Lapsus did not steal any source code for Microsoft's desktop software, such as Windows 11 Server or The Office. Microsoft might be or may be the latest victim, but over the past few months, the Lapsus group has made a name for itself by successfully attacking NVIDIA, Samsung, Vodafone, Ubisoft, and Mercado Libre. While it's still unknown how the group has managed to target the source code repositories of so many big companies in such a short time, some security researchers believe Lapsus is paying corporate insiders for access. In fact, in a previous post on its fast-growing Telegram channel, the group said that it actively recruits employees, insiders at telecoms, or employees and insiders at telecoms, large software and gaming companies, call centers, dedicated server hosting providers. That probably works a lot better than anybody wants to admit, by the way, because you don't have to target the high-level guys who are making, you know, tons of money. You go target, you know, the low-end guys who have access to the system, but, you know, they're on the help desk, or your low-level sysops guys who are, like, you know, you're not, maybe not interns, but you're, you know, level one sysops and admins and guys who are, you know, the functionaries.
Anyone at a call center.
Yeah. you know, the little people in a company. Secretaries, actually, are fantastic. If you're wanting access to all of the big corporate, because they all have access to everyone's calendars and data, because, you know, the whole point of the secretary is that you don't want this high-powered executive who costs a ton of money wasting all their time filling out a calendar. you know, that's kind of the point of having, I guess they call them admins these days, administrative assistants, but, you know, that's why they have them, is to manage the calendars and all the stuff you don't want the executives doing, because you pay them too much to sit around managing a calendar. But, yeah, if you can get into their systems, or better yet, just pay one a lot of, you know, think about it. You go offer some of these level one guys who probably don't make $75,000 a year, you know, give them $1,000, you know, give them $100,000. They'll give you anything you want, probably. So yeah, I'm sure that's what they're doing. Yeah.
But, can you please plug this into your computer when you go to work?
Yeah. Yeah, flash this on, you know, take this image, burn it to a flash drive, go plug it into your work machine. Yeah, I mean, I totally see that. Well, they probably talk to them a bit first to understand what, you know, what their environment's like and stuff like that. But, you know, yeah, grab this NUC, install this operating system, don't ask questions, and just plug it in under your desk. You know, shit like that. I could totally see shit like that. Besides recruitment, Lapsus uses its Telegram channel to announce new attacks and leaks, as well as for self-promotion. The group has already amassed close to 40,000 subscribers on the platform, which it uses to chat with its fans. Now that Lapsus Group has gained a great deal of notoriety online, expect law enforcement agencies and even large companies like Microsoft to begin taking action to disrupt activities before it strikes again. So, yeah, I imagine there's a...
I have a follow-up to that story there, Morps.
Oh, yeah?
If you want to do that, if you think we've got time.
Oh, yeah. What is it, 9,
I read 17? This story this morning, and I didn't put two and two together with the lapses.
Okay. Well, let's throw this link in. We'll add it to the notes here shortly. Al Hazard has a link for me from the register, too, if we go too quick through all of them. New Linux kernel improvements. Okay. Well, we can look at that if we get through it too quickly. Let's see, this goes here. So this says, Oxford team accused of being multi-millionaire cyber criminal. A 16-year-old from Oxford is accused of being one of the leaders of the cybercrime gang Lapsus. The teenager, who is alleged to have amassed a $14 million fortune from hacking, has been named by rival hackers and researchers. City of London police say they arrested 7 teenagers in relation to the gang, but they will not say if he is one. The boy's father...
Just hold it right there, Moops. City of London police. So not the UK police. The City of London.
Yeah.
Exactly. So this kid is money. Lots of money. Probably from a very wealthy family. You don't live in the City of London if you ain't got money.
Yeah, that's so those, old London, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the original one going back to the 1600s when London itself was captured, and they were the last holdout and negotiated their own city. So there's a city inside of London City called London City, which has its own police force, its own parliament system, everything, and it does not operate under UK law. But worth having a look at if you got a couple of hours you want to read. But anyway, that's all. I just wanted to point that out, that we're not dealing with Joe Bloggs from Essex or something like that. This is serious money.
Well, I mean, the story reads like that, too. The boy's father told the BBC that his family was concerned and trying to keep him away from his computers. If the family's trying to keep him away from the computers, I mean... Under his online moniker, White, or Breachbase, the teenager, who has autism, is said to be behind the prolific Lapsus hacker crew, which is believed to be based in South America. Lapsus is relatively new, but has become one of the most talked about and feared hacker cybercrime gangs after successfully breaching major firms like Microsoft and bragging about it online. Well, there's your problem. You bragged about it online. The teenager, who can't be named for legal reasons, attends a special education course in Oxford. City of London police said 7 people between the ages of 16 and 21 have been arrested in connection with the investigation of a hacking group. They've all been released under investigation. Our inquiries remain ongoing. The boy's father...
Okay, that reads like the kid goes to a retard school, right? Because he's got autism? It's not. I'm going to dig and find out what school this is, but I guarantee you this special education school is for the gifted and talented.
It's like some fancy prep school.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, they prep you to be a, you know, spy or a fucking, you know,
somebody
diplomat.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're groomed from day one.
So, the boy's father told the BBC, "I'd never heard anything about this until recently. He's never talked about hacking, but he's very good on computers and spends a lot of time on there. I always thought he was playing games. We're going to try to stop him from getting on computers. Good luck."
It sounds like a father really devoted to trying to stop his kid from using PCs. I'm going to try and stop him.
The BBC had also spoken to the boy's mother, who did not want to comment. So even though they're not naming who this guy is, the BBC knows who he is.
Yeah. It's not going to take me long to figure out who this kid is.
The reason they're not naming him is because he's a minor.
I know.
Oh, that. I'm going to figure it out.
White was outed or doxxed on a hacker website after an apparent falling out with business partners. The hackers revealed his name, address, and social media pictures. They also posted a biography of his hacking career, saying, after a few years, his net worth accumulated well over 300 BTC. He is now affiliated with the wannabe ransomware group known as Lapsus, who has been extorting and, quote, hacking, unquote, several organizations, unquote. So they, the other groups are even questioning how they're hacking. But if this kid's come from money, he very well might be doing the whole, hey, yeah, we'll give you $10,000. Go plug this into your computer at work.
Yeah.
And I mean, if that's what he's doing, I'd see why the other groups are saying, you're not even, what are you doing? That's not hacking. That's just extortion and corporate espionage. So just. But, as first reported by Bloomberg, cybersecurity researchers have been tracking White for nearly a year and have linked him to Latsus and other hacking incidents. Quote, "We've had his name since the middle of last year when we identified him before the doxing," unquote, said Allison Nixon, chief security researcher at cybersecurity investigation company Unit 221B. That's a very ominous name for a research unit, isn't it? That's the company name. Quote, "Unit 221B working with cybersecurity company Palo Alto because they don't want to be in the city, I get you. After identifying the actor, watched him on his exploits throughout of 2021, periodically sending law enforcement a heads up about the latest crimes," unquote. Ms. Nixon said researchers tracked him through a trail of activity linked through nearly unbroken stream of the boy's online accounts. We, quote, "We did it by watching his post history of an account and seeing older posts provide contact information for the guy," unquote. So, not good OPSEC. Ms. Nixon said the trail was followed thanks to mistakes White made in failing to cover his tracks. The Lapsus cyber extortion group has gained notoriety in a short space of time thanks to its high-profile targets and active presence on the messaging app Telegram. The channel has grown to 47,000 subscribers. A last message was posted on the channel Wednesday with the group saying a few of our members had a vacation until 33/2022, so we might be quiet for some time. Thanks for understanding. We'll try to leak some stuff ASAP. Chris Morgan from cybersecurity company Digital Shadows said Lapsus has risen in prominence in recent months. Quote, "After targeting several enterprise technology companies, breaching significant amounts of data, and posting on their dedicated Telegram data leak channel," unquote. Quote, "Little is known of the origins of the group. However, given that Lapsus' initial activity was directed towards several online organizations in Brazil, some researchers have speculated the group is based in South America," unquote, Mr. Morgan said. In a Wednesday blog post, Microsoft said Lapsus has gained limited access to its system. Security company Okta admitted that it too had been hacked by the group, with consequences for hundreds of its clients. That's amusing because we were on some calls at work a few days ago, and Okta was saying, "Oh, no, we weren't hacked. It was just a third-party supplier." Yeah, they're totally doing damage control. So, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting way to go, but if you're just buying your way into companies, it's questionable how much hacking you're really doing. Yeah. I don't know that that's what he was doing, though. He might have been doing the phishing, he might have been doing real exploits. I mean, there's enough of them floating around these days. So, because everything's flipping web-based. Compromise the right web-based thing, and then you get everyone who uses it, right? So,
I was just thinking from a user point of view, how much of a difference is it they hacked your vendor or they hacked you? They're still in your system.
Now, from the user point of view,
they still got my shit.
There's none, and it's still going to be your name's the one on the contract. Your throat is the one to choke, if you know the expression. So, let's see. Next one up is from The Verge. So, I could just talk about this one. I don't really need to read it. So, the new Mac Studios have come out with Apple's latest rev of their M1 chip. And, you know, this is, I guess, their replacement for the Mac Pros now. But, you know, as they started shipping, a couple of people started doing teardowns on YouTube. And Apple had said that these things are not in-user serviceable. They're not upgradable. You know, if you want storage, you got to pay exorbitant rates to us to get more, you know, to get more SSD space in them when you buy them because you can't put more in later. Well, some guys on YouTube, I think the first one to do it was, what was this guy's name? Luke Miami? Miami? M-I-A-N-I. Miami? I don't know how you say that. Apparently, he took his apart and figured out that it actually has an M2 slot in there. And that what Apple has done is they have used software to lock the SSDs to the M2 slot. So
bastards.
Not only can you not upgrade them because it's software, like there's no hardware reason you couldn't swap in a bigger drive after you buy it, but it's that SSD is locked to that Mac because he took apart. Apparently, he bought two of these things or more than two of them. Took two of them apart. Which Apple makes hard. Like there's I watched the teardown video of one of these things to get into it. They've got a ring on the bottom of it that I guess is like the grip stuff so that it doesn't slide around the desk. Well, you have to basically rip that off and destroy it to get to where the screws are. So there's no non-destructive way of opening the damn thing. But it didn't have to. You didn't have to do that, right? You know, you could have. You could have, because they're screws. But they put it under this thing that if you want to open it, you have to destroy to get to the screws. But yeah, he tried grabbing the SSD out of another of the same SKU of machine and swapping them. It still wouldn't work. They are software locked to that machine. So yeah, I mean it's literally just Apple doing that so that you have to buy the storage from them at build time, that you cannot upgrade it later. Now, I did see some posts floating around some of the Linux forums that the guys who are working on getting Linux running on these chips have included a driver for those M2 slots. So if you're not going to run macOS on it, if you're going to run Linux on it, you potentially could swap it out for your own storage and run their driver, but it's still pretty early days for it. I would question why, you know, you would do that, why you would spend the retarded amount of money on this and then run a Linux SKU. I mean, if you want to run a Linux build, I think you'd have better luck with like a high-end Threadripper build or something, you know? Rather than going with the Apple chips. That said, I mean, if that's what somebody wants to do, I mean, the Mac processor is interesting. The Apple processor is interesting, so I kind of get the reason for doing that. I wouldn't see that as a productive machine. I would see that as a research project. maybe that'll change when they get a little farther along with it, but I guess to me that seems like an odd choice, you know? But I mean, if it is software locked, eventually somebody's going to crack it, and you'll be able to, you know, swap these things out for larger ones, and then just run whatever unlocker tool somebody puts together to be able to install your own storage in these things. But I mean, come on, really?
Yeah.
How long do you think it'll take for someone to unlock it?
Well, they've already got the thing running on the Linux side of the house, so I really just depends on how much effort somebody wants to put into doing it. So the article goes on lambasting how it's, you know, shame Apple's done this, that they didn't have to. There's no reason to bury the thing behind rubber gaskets and all that. I guess I can read some of what the author put here. Because the Mac Studio does have removable SSDs, nothing about Apple's design necessitates the choice to bury it behind rubber sheets and potentially dangerous power supply or to lock it on a software level. Oh, yeah, I didn't even mention the power supply. So in the teardown video I saw, the live voltage is basically going through a couple of screw posts that are just right there on the board.
Nice.
So there's some pretty high amperage capacitors on that 12-volt supply, and it's just a couple of post screws going down with a little sticker on top. So if you've had the thing on, be very careful when you pull it apart, because that power supply has got nothing protecting it, and it's just a couple of screw posts. One slip with a screwdriver, and you're going to get the shock that you do not want. But Apple made an active choice to make it impossible to upgrade the Mac Studio's internal storage, whether it was hoping to discourage end users from tearing apart their computers in search of cheaper SSD upgrades, or because it wants to nudge customers into its pricier options, which, due to non-replaceable nature, implicitly urges you to buy more up front, lest be caught with, you know, too little after the fact. Both options don't reflect well on the company. It's true that the Mac Studio makes it exceedingly difficult for customers to get to the SSD slots in the first place, but that's also a choice Apple made. Isn't a laptop or a tablet, or even an ultra-slim all-in-one like the M1 iMac, it's a desktop computer, one that presumably could have offered more expandable storage at the expense of a slightly bigger chassis. Nor can Apple make the argument that it has for things like unified memory, which offers tangible benefits by not being a user-replaceable component. The SSDs here are already removable. Apple is just preventing studio owners from doing it themselves. And Apple apparently sells SSDs after the market for their 2019 Mac Pro. So I imagine what they'll eventually do is offer an upgrade thing where you take it into their stores, the Genius, whatever, and then pay a stupid amount of money to have one of them do it and put their stuff in it, you know? But, let's see. So it looks like down in the comments, some people are getting close to cracking it. Apparently, Sarsaparilla Fist says the Mac Studio requires an IPSW restore after changing its SSD modules to ensure they're readable and able to boot, and they have to match in size. There's the Mac Rumors article that links to it. So apparently, you can. You know, some people are figuring out how to do it, but it reads like it's a right pain in the ass. So you will own nothing, I guess.
Oh, and you will like it.
You'll own it, but you'll only be able to do what the fuck I want you to do with it.
Yeah, that's even worse. Well, Apple's got another "you will own nothing" thing going. It's suspected, but apparently they're going to start offering the rumor is that they're going to start offering a iPhone subscription plan, where instead of buying your phone, you're renting it from Apple for whatever the monthly cost is, and you get a new one every 12 months, but, you know, you got to pay the monthly cost on the thing. And I didn't see what that number was, so I doubt it's going to be a very, you know, I doubt it's going to be a cheaper deal than buying new hardware. You know what I mean?
How fucking wasteful is that? How often is the jump from iPhone from the last generation to the newest generation of iPhone that big a jump?
They're almost never a big jump. It's always incremental. Like, you know, if you jump a couple generations, yeah, you'll notice it's, you know, snappier, faster, new features, better camera. But if you're doing the incrementals, which I know a few people who do that, and it's like, you know, it's always just little stuff. It's never, you know, huge increases in speed, huge increases in the camera. It's always just, you know, incremental. I know with some of the iPads, when they put the new M1 chip in them, that made them supposedly faster, but none of the software is really taking advantage of that from what I can tell. Like, none of the apps really need it. So, yeah, I don't know. And of course, what do you do with all the old hardware? I guess they're probably refurbing it and sending it down the line, but still.
Yeah, at that point, it's no longer, here's my great product, this will make your life better, easier, whatever. It's buy this for the sake of buying it, and oh yeah, you won't even own this shit. Just give me money.
Well, I mean,
I hate that business model.
Well, and two, what happens when you crack the screen on one of these rented things? You know, I mean, I'm sure you got to pay for it.
Oh, yeah, just you have a cracked screen until your rental on that one is up, and you send it in and get your new one.
Yeah. So, I don't know, man. I don't like the direction these things are going. The technology is great at a base level, but the way they're going with these things, man, seems pretty abusive.
Yeah. That... and making it even hard to repair pisses me off.
Oh, I know. Have you even looked at what it takes to get into a cell phone or a tablet these days? It's a right pain in the butt. I mean, you got to have a temperature-controlled hot plate to soften the glue. You got to have the right tools to get into the thing. You got to have the little tools to undo the little clips so you don't tear the damn ribbon cables. It is an absolute pain. I mean, it's no wonder they discourage anybody from working on these things.
And if you don't want to repair it yourself, having it repaired, you might as well just buy another damn phone.
Well, especially for the rates they cost or charge to repair them. Like, I've got an older iPad that still works, but the battery's shot in it. It keeps about a charge for about half an hour when you unplug it, so you know, terribly useful there. And I've thought about taking it to one of those, you know, phone repair swap places just to see if I can get somebody to stick a new battery in the thing. But it's like, I price some of them out, and it's like, I might as well just get on eBay and buy a new one, you know? Get a secondhand one that's a few generations up from this thing, and it'd be a better machine anyways. So, I don't know, man. It's sad because it used to be, like, you know, your old desktop computer, you could sit there and swap parts in the thing for years and, you know, get a lot of life out of it. You know, one of the first machines I built was built from scratch as opposed to just upgrading, was a Pentium 2 machine, which I was able to put a Pentium 3 in at some point with one of those card slot adapters, and I think I went through three different graphics cards, a ton of memory upgrades. I mean, you know, we got years out of that build just by doing, you know, some upgrades and stuff like that, but you can't do that anymore. So, I mean, hell, go back and look at the old 8-bit machines and the shit people came up with for those. Yeah, now it's all locked out and commoditized, I guess would be the term. So, anyways, do you have anything on that?
No, I'm good. My ball phone's on my thing, dude. So,
all right, well, let's continue with the tech companies being annoying. This one's from Ars Technica. Desktop watermarks comes to users of unsupported Windows 11 PCs. So, Windows 11 has stricter system... I don't know why anybody cares, really. I don't. Windows 11 has stricter system requirements than any Windows version before it, dropping support for a wide range of pre-2018 PCs in the name of improving Windows platform security baseline. You can work around these requirements to install Windows 11 on unsupported PCs relatively easily, but Microsoft adds warnings to its installer and threatens to withhold updates from these systems. So far, the company hasn't actually followed through on that threat, but using Windows 11 on these somewhat older computers is about to get more annoying.
Hold up. Am I hearing this correctly? So I can have a legit copy of Windows, but because I haven't upgraded my computer as often as they want, they're going to stop supporting the thing I bought and paid for the support for.
Yep.
Channel edited.
So, yep, that is exactly right. That they are going to just yank the support for it. So a new Windows 11 update adds a, quote, system requirements not met, unquote, watermark to the desktop of unsupported PCs. So, yeah, similar to the watermark you might see if you're running an early beta or an unactivated version of Windows. The screenshot below is from a PC that supports TPM 2.0 and Secure Boot, but uses an unsupported 6th generation Intel Core CPU. And, yeah, down in the bottom, right above the taskbar, little piece of text right over your wallpaper, system requirements not met, so you go to settings to learn more. So, Apparently, that message is going to pop up in several places. The message will presumably appear when your PC doesn't meet one or more of the operating system's core security requirements, a supported Intel, AMD, or ARM processor, secure boot support, and TPM 2.0 hardware or firmware. This means that it may also appear for users of PCs that are fully capable of meeting Windows 11 requirements, but they have secure boot or TPM turned off either by accident or on purpose. Many motherboard BIOSes come with one or other disabled by default for years, though recent updates have changed those. The new Windows 11 version, build number 22000.588, is currently in the Windows Insider Release Preview channel, reserved for updates that will roll out to everyone within a few days or weeks. This means that most people with unsupported hardware will begin seeing this message sooner rather than later, provided they're keeping their PCs up to date. Messages like this one were discovered in Windows 11 beta builds in early February, suggesting that Microsoft has been considering the changes for a while. For now, the watermark doesn't actually affect anything, but these Windows 11 PCs will continue to operate as they did before. The watermark should be possible to disable via registry edits if that's something you're comfortable with, but it's proof that Microsoft can continue to distinguish between supported and unsupported PCs after you've installed the operating system, and that the company could use that distinction to withhold updates or disable Windows features in the future. So, I can, you know, from a professional standpoint, I can think of a few reasons that watermark might actually be handy. If you're concerned that you're using a system that doesn't meet a corporate security requirement, having that flag on there might actually be somewhat useful. That said, the people who I work with who I would want to pay attention to such a flag never would. Also, I don't know why anybody would update to Windows 11 yet. Apparently that thing is still being hammered on pretty badly. And yeah, I've got a couple of machines now that are saying, oh, you're eligible. Click here when ready. It's like, no. Fuck that.
It's going to be the same thing with Windows 10. Eventually, you're just not going to have a choice.
Yeah, eventually you're going to wake up one day, turn on your computer, and it's going to say installing Windows 11. And
you're
going to
panic and try and reverse it.
And you'll just be sitting there just throwing both, you know, flicking it off as hard as you can because there's nothing else you can do.
Was Windows XP the last good Windows?
Earlier builds of 7 were pretty good. After, you know, before 10 came out, the builds of 7 were pretty good. When 10 came out, they added the telemetry because they wanted to, you know, they kind of back through a bunch of stuff from 10 onto 7, and that kind of messed with it. But, I imagine what's going to happen is Microsoft is going to keep adding all this bullshit to the top of their OS, and eventually you're going to have enough corporate customers complaining that these things are a pain to manage with all this crap that they have to go into, you know, registry editors, SCCM and PC policies and all this other shit to disable that... either Microsoft will back off because they start to lose corporate customers over to Apple, or you'll see some new competitor pop up and start taking market share from them. I don't know that it'll be a Linux. Probably it'll be a Linux because it'll be easier to build off top of a Linux build than just writing something new from scratch. But maybe it'll be sort of like what IBM did back in the day, where they had stuff that would run on top of Windows or OS 2 or whatever other operating system to give you that corporate environment. So, I don't know. Also, too, with everything kind of moving cloud-based for a lot of corporate apps these days, I mean, you might see Chromebooks come in and kind of take over from Windows in the corporate environment if Microsoft keeps this bullshit up. Because... you know, eventually you're going to have companies say, why are we bothering with this if everything's web browser based anyways? But you'll see, I mean, I envision eventually you're going to have enough people annoyed with this that they'll move off of Windows to other things. The problem is, I don't know if that's true. I mean, people put up with a lot of bullshit if they think there's not other options out there, you know?
Yeah.
What I would see is a skewing of Windows to the corporate world where that shit's not on it, and they'll keep it for the consumer market.
Oh, so you have the consumer build that's like super cheap or even free. Then you have the corporate license that's like $300. So, yeah.
Yeah, and the consumer's just getting shit on because how many of them care?
Well, they put up with a lot, but, you know, I could see that costing Windows market share if they keep this crap up. So, next article is from ScienceAlert.com, and this is just kind of neat. Brain implant enables a completely, quote, locked-in man to communicate again. A pair of brain microchips could one day allow those in pseudocomas to communicate whenever they want, a new breakthrough suggests. In a first, a 34-year-old patient who lacked even the most subtle of muscle twitches has used the technology to share a few precious words with his family, using little more than an intent to move his eyes. Similar devices have previously given patients with the fast progressing condition, ALS, the means to send simple messages with extremely limited movements, but researchers say the sensitivity or severity of the man's condition here represents a significant advancement of the technology. Quote, to our knowledge, this is the first study to achieve communication by someone who has no remaining voluntary movement and hence for whom the BCI is now the sole means of communication. Unquote, said neuroscientist Jonas Zimmermann from the Weiss Center in Switzerland. A pseudocoma is also known as locked-in syndrome because while these patients cannot walk or talk, they are still very much conscious, capable of seeing, hearing, tasting, smelling, thinking, and feeling. There's a nightmare scenario.
That is an argument for suicide. Or euthanasia, because you can't kill yourself at that point.
What did the guy say? Kill me? I mean...
Yeah, that's... very hardcore pro-life. Like, I question whether any euthanasia law should be legitimate. But that condition, that is the argument saying, okay, sometimes...
I mean, that's terrifying.
It could be humane to pull the plug.
That is just terrifying. Because, think about how insane... somebody would be after a couple of, I don't know, years of that. Of course, I don't know how long you would be able to, how long you would actually survive without being able to move, so I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, coma patients actually live for a while, but, you know, they're in a coma on life support.
Yeah, they also develop bed sores and heart problems that you don't really hear about.
Yeah. Without the ability to move the mouth or the tongue, however, communication is severely limited. If the eyes can still move, patients can sometimes blink or point with their pupils to make themselves understood. But in some advanced cases, even the basic form of that basic form of communication is out of reach. The man in this case is one such patient. Within months of diagnosis with the condition, he had already lost the ability to walk and talk. A year later, the patient was placed on a ventilator to help him breathe. A year after that, he lost the ability to fix his gait. 2 years from diagnosis to...
ALS is quick, man.
That is terrifying. The extreme isolation ultimately led the patient and his family to agree to a cutting-edge experiment. Before the patient lost the ability to move his eyes, he consented to a surgical procedure that would implant 2 microchips into the part of his brain that control muscle movement. Each chip was equipped with 64 needle-like electrodes, which could pick up on his conscious attempts to move. That brain activity was then sent to a computer, which translated the impulses into a yes or no. In the past, similar brain implants have allowed some patients with ALS to communicate with a computer typing program, but this is the first time an ALS patient without the ability to so much as use their eyes has been able to do something similar. Quote, people have really doubted whether this was even feasible, unquote, Marcika Van Stinsel, a brain-computer interface researcher who was not involved in the study, told Science. The technique took months of training, but once the patient learned how to control the firing rates of his brain signals, he was able to respond to a spelling program and select specific letters spoken out loud by the program to form words and even sentences. Each letter the patient heard took about a minute for the patient to respond to, making for slow progress, but nonetheless, for the first time in a long time, the device allowed the man to express himself. The accuracy of the technology is still not perfect. The patient could only signal yes or no about 80% of the time, with about 80% accuracy. Some days he could only generate words, not sentences. Quote, these apparent poor performances are primarily due to the completely auditory nature of these systems, which are intrinsically slower than a system based on visual feedback, the authors wrote in the study. The first phase of the ALS patient successfully spelled out first phrase the ALS patient successfully spelled out was a thank you to the lead neurobiologist on his case, Niles Breibauer. Then came a slew of requests for his care, like mom head massage and I would like to listen to an album by Tool. Loud. Good man. Fuck. Fuck.
Dude, imagine how ecstatic the dude is. Like, fucking change the channel. I can't watch Home Shopping Network anymore. Yeah. My left nut itches. Scratch it.
Then,
good on you, man. I hope you get good.
247 days after the surgical procedure, the patient gave his verdict on the device. Boys, it worked so effortlessly. Then, on day 251, he sent a message to his kid. I love my cool son. Then he asked his child to watch a Disney film with him. On day 462, the patient expressed that his biggest wish is a new bed, and the next day he could go with his loved ones to a barbecue. Quote, if someone is forming sentences like this, I would say it's positive. Even if it is not positive, it's not negative. The first author of the study, Ujwai Chaudhry, told The Guardian. I'm butchering these names. Sorry. Quote, one time when I was there, he said, thank you for everything, sister, to his sister who helps care for them. It was an emotional moment. The ability for someone in a pseudo-coma to communicate obviously comes with a whole slew of ethical considerations. After all, who condones the initial insertion? Once the person has learned to communicate again, can they speak for themselves and the future of their care? How accurate do these systems need to be before we can adequately interpret what the patients are telling? Well, you know what? If the guy is asking for specifics like a Tool album, I'd say you're...
Yeah.
We don't have rules or outlines for this type of technology quite yet, but if the device turns out to be useful to other patients, we'll need to start confronting the quandaries. Given advanced ALS patients, their voices back could be a huge medical breakthrough and a great relief for individuals and their families. How we respond to those voices is up to us. Well, I kind of wonder if... if you're that far gone with ALS that you don't have any voluntary motion left... I mean, somebody else has got to decide for you, right? I almost wonder why wouldn't you? I mean,
that's why you organize all that once you're diagnosed.
Like, yeah.
It's shitty because you've only got a small window to make some of the biggest fucking decisions you'll ever make. Like, who becomes my primary carer? Who looks after my money? Who feeds me? Who toilets me? It's... Fucking yeah, it's a goddamn nightmare, and I wouldn't wish it on anyone.
Well, as far as testing accuracy, I think the only way to truly have a test of that wouldn't it be to implant it in someone who's healthy and then see what they can do with it. Because they can also tell you, I was trying to spell the word thank you, doctor.
Yeah.
Otherwise, is this just pre-programmed responses?
No, I'd say, I suppose he's got no expression, has he?
Yeah. So he can't say
disappointment.
Yeah, I was wanting to listen to Tool, or you idiots, I meant Creep by Radiohead. This is the doctor yanking your chain.
Well, thanks, man. It went for a fucking super awesome story to like, oh, now I don't believe this. Now I'm all bummed out again. I was like, wow, that just made my week. Usually it's the other way around. I fuck you up, madman, with fucking truth. God damn.
Well, either way, I kind of hope this works because you're looking at Ghost in the Shell 0.00001 here. So.
Yeah, no, it's fucking super cool. And I really do hope that that dude is communicating exactly what he wants.
I mean, I doubt it's the doctor yanking the chain because they're talking about hundreds of days to learn how to use the thing, right?
Oh, I don't doubt it would have taken him hundreds of days. And the longer it's in there, the more he's going to be able to use it, as long as it seems to be accurate. But as you said, we need to implant it in a healthy human and get them to work around with it.
Well, that'll be the thing, right? Is it's going to be... Oh, yeah, that would be what you would do with it, is you would implant it in somebody who's, like, lost a limb. So instead of trying to communicate with it, you use it to, you know, you use it to replace the missing motor, the motor control for the missing limb, and then that way they can confirm that it's accurate through whatever it is you hook it up to, whether it's like a computer and showing something on a screen or like a prosthetic there's, so that you could, you know, show the movement of the feet, of the hand.
There's been a lot of breakthrough with prosthetic hands and stuff like that with just twitch fiber muscles.
Yeah.
Being hooked to electrodes. So you don't even actually need any invasive surgeries or anything like that. The sensors on them are good enough to where you can actually get a grip strength.
Like well, but with this guy's ALS, it sounds like getting the muscle, you reading the muscles is useless.
Amputations and ALS, completely two different balls. Like, oh, okay. I think you're going to have to just implant it in a normal human and try and I mean, a human that can communicate verbally and use that machine and experiment that way and try and keep it paced the same way he did, you know, day one, day 100, day 200, day 400, you know.
Yeah.
And okay, compare that data. But then that's only two. You're going to need – that'll let you know whether it's correct. Okay? But you still need a bigger pool to see whether it's actually worth doing it more. But if you got ALS, man, you ain't got much – might as well gamble. That's my
I mean, I would.
Anyway.
If I was in that situation, I'd fucking do it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's shit tons of diseases. I'm like, screw whether it's FDA approved. The guy's got this. Snake oil at this point is worth trying.
It's like, yeah, let's try anything. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm down like that, too. As long as I get the chance to opt out towards the end.
So, all right. Last article I have for you tonight is from the Financial Times, FT.com. Japanese startup wants to cause real-life pain in the metaverse.
Good.
Oh, it explains. A Japanese technology startup is banking on being able to deliver physical pain to people in the metaverse, one of a growing number of companies vying to profit by providing real-life human experiences in virtual worlds. And we're starting with pain. H2L, a Sony-backed company founded a decade ago, has built a product that features an armband to detect the flexing of human muscles, enabling the user's avatar in the metaverse to copy the body's movements, and for people to actually feel the presence and weight of objects. The technology uses electrical stimulation to manipulate the arm muscles and mimic sensations, such as catching a ball or a bird pecking at the skin. Quote, feeling pain enables us to turn the metaverse into a real world with increasing feelings of presence and immersions, unquote.
Oh, sweet. My crushing fetish cannot be realized.
Said Emi Tamaki, a chief executive and co-founder of the Tokyo-based Al-Hazad in the chat room. And finally, I can enjoy BDSM in the metaverse.
God damn it. See, this is why I say you got to learn to hate the people that like this show. You know, terrible people. Madman, you're a terrible person, too.
Hey, just because I can now have Brunhilde squish my balls in the metaverse doesn't make this weird for anyone but you.
And the person who has to put on the Brunhilde avatar.
Oh, no. They're already into this if they're wearing Brunhilde. That and do they need to know what I'm having them do?
Actually, no, I guess you could just get a bot to do it.
Yeah, I could just be like, I need you to keep punching me, and this band's just around my balls.
Tamaki is a researcher in haptic technologies, which relate to the sense of touch. Her goal is to, quote, release humans from any sort of constraint in terms of space, body, and time, unquote, by 2029. With advances in networks and electronic devices, she expects H2L products to have a myriad of applications. Tamaki's decade...
There's already a product that does this. It's It's called heroin.
Temaki's decade-old company belongs to a growing segment of Japanese companies and investors tapping into the blurring boundary between the real world and the metaverse. As big companies or big tech groups invest heavily in the sector, Facebook rebranded as Meta last October as a social media group looks to focus on building virtual worlds. The top 10 virtual reality startups in Japan have raised $60 million combined, according to the data provided by Traxen. Meta announced in November that it was developing a haptic vibrating glove, and Spanish startup OWO has developed a jacket equipped with sensors to allow the user to feel sensations ranging from hugs to gunshots. H2L is estimated to have raised ¥1 billion and is valued at about ¥5 billion and hopes to launch an initial public offering worth ¥20 billion within the next 5 years, according to people with knowledge of the company's plans. Temaki started working in haptics after she had a near-death experience in her late teens linked to a congenital heart disease. She came up with the idea to create technology that would allow physical experience to be linked with computers when she was in the hospital, and co-founded the company after acquiring her PhD in engineering from the University of Tokyo. Quote, I realized life was precious, and I decided to work in a new field that I really wanted to dig into, as there was no one doing research at the time, she said. Temaki said the technology could be used for games, but people could also use it to feel virtual world events in real life. For example, the technology could convey the feeling of participating in an activity from the user's childhood, such as throwing a ball with a parent.
Oh.
By replicating the senses associated with tossing and catching a ball where the activity plays out in the virtual world. Quote, people like me who can not go out often because I don't have enough muscle due to heart disease can travel anywhere, anytime, she said.
Oh, that means when I'm watching my government hand down the budget, I can feel that pressure on my asshole.
Can the metaverse hurt me in the past? Yeah. It's like, show me on the doll where the metaverse hurt you.
Yeah.
Oh, God. No one ever... They're reporting rape. It could almost kind of possibly be sort of true.
Oh, the metaverse. I didn't even think about that one. Oh, boy. All right. You guys ready to do Dojo?
Yep. Good.
All right, for Dojo, I've only got one thing for you tonight, and it's this interesting app I found called Speak. So what? Or Speak.chat. So what this thing is it's an instant messenger that is open source, cross-platform, and it runs over Tor. So instead of creating a user account with a service, this thing is totally peer-to-peer, and you set up hidden service keys to be your user account. And of course, then, you know, whoever you friend can, you know, have a display name or whatever, right? But, and then it's a fairly modern kind of Telegram style or Discord style chat, but instead of connecting to a centralized server and registering with an account, it's all peer-to-peer. It's all going through Tor, so potentially you're not supposed to be discoverable. They say, oh, you can chat without exposing your identity or your IP address to anybody. Nobody can discover who your contacts are when you talk. There are no servers or operators that could be compromised, exposing your information, and it's cross-platform and easy for non-technical users. So I don't know how much I buy the nobody could identify you, because there's the whole, like they show it loading an image, right? And it should be loading those things through Tor of some sort to hide it, but that's usually the trick with Tor, is you trick their browser into loading something through the ClearNet to get an identity on them. And also, too, you're hoping that, you know, you don't convince somebody to reveal something important about themselves, like, say, like a username or, you know, an actual identity or address, right? So there's still some... I'd say it's not a perfect system, but if you're looking for some kind of an encrypted messenger that you can run cross-platform on desktops that goes through Tor, I mean, if nothing else, maybe for the novelty aspect of it, this looks like a fun project. So all right. So I'm guessing Madman and RU have nothing on that. Cool.
Oh, good little program. Nice to know it's there if I need it.
Yep.
It sounds like it could be the newest version of Skype. you know, before Windows bought it and turned it into crap.
Well, there's no voice chat that I can tell, so I don't know that it's a direct replacement for Skype. It looks more like a pretty good replacement for AIM or IRC or ICQ. So, IRC too, I guess. But of course, listening to the stream, we're always working on it. Peer decking every Thursday, the Galaxy 15 radio site and subreddit in the IRC tonight. Al Hazard, Cyberlard, Cykros, Madman, and myself. Are you? Closing thoughts.
Super excited. Doug Stanhope's new comedy special is out. But just a heads up, if you do not know who Doug Stanhope is, it may not be for you. Is you're either going to be into it, or are you just going to go, I can't believe you suggested this, and turn it off?
All right, Madman, closing thoughts.
I don't see why I work from the office at all anymore.
To make a manager feel better about themselves and to make your company not feel so silly for investing in an office.
Okay.
Seriously, that's the only reasons I can come up with for most people whose jobs are computer-based. Is either you've got management that's insecure about not having you in a physical location where they can watch to make sure you're actually working, or they think they've wasted money in an office building and don't like that idea.
But on the upside, today I did get free ice cream.
Oh, well, that's always something. All right, time to play sound effects and close us out.
Sorry, your call cannot be completed as dialed.